The UFO phenomenon in its totality is surprisingly complex. Understandably, this is not recognized by the general public. Although various opinion polls indicate that the majority of the population feel that UFOs are for real, only patient study, and even more important, direct involvement with the witnesses to this greatly perplexing phenomenon can demonstrate the extent of the complexity. The man on the street's simple opinion that either UFOs are all nonsense or that visitors from outer space do exist is brutally destroyed by close study. But this is not a new insight. In science, it is well recognized that investigations into many subjects spawn more questions than they answer. In the area of UFOs, deeper acquaintance reveals a subject that has not only potentially important scientific aspects, but sociological, psychological, and even theological aspects as well. The Andreasen case involves all these aspects, so much so, and in such bizarre fashion, that in the past I frankly would not have touched an invitation to write the foreword for a book treating contactees, abduction, mental telepathy, mystical symbolism, and physical contact and examination by aliens. But across the years, I have learned to broaden my view of the entire UFO phenomenon, and I now realize that it is a composite of many inputs. It does not seem to be just one single thing, but, as has often happened in science, what at first seemed to have just one component has turned out to have several. This book really started with a letter to me from the principal witness. At that time, I had neither the spare hours nor, I confess, the inclination to follow it up, and I let the letter lie for some time. Then one day I reread it. Here was a sincere person asking assistance, not knowing where to turn, and I felt I could not be callous and consign the long unanswered letter to the circular file. It occurred to me that, because Ray Fowler and his associates were not too far from the witness, they might do the Center for UFO Studies and me a favor and discharge the obligation that the letter implicitly imposed. I am glad that Mr. Fowler undertook what at first must have seemed an unwelcome task, but he and his associates did, and there has resulted a most interesting book. No, interesting is not sufficient. It is a book that will captivate, bother, intrigue, and even frighten as one pursues it and contemplates its implications. Fowler is to be complimented on his perseverance in the investigation of this case of very high strangeness. It leads down many paths that make Alice's wanderings in Wonderland pale by comparison. And those who still hold that the entire subject of UFOs is nonsense will be sorely challenged if they have the courage to take an honest look at the present book. For whatever the UFO phenomenon is or are, it is not nonsense. It would take an imagination of the highest order to explain the reported happenings described herein as mere misidentifications of balloons, aircraft, meteors, or planets. Neither is there the slightest evidence of hoax or contrivance. The present work will also challenge those who consider UFOs solely synonymous with physical craft that transport flesh and blood denizens from distant solar systems. A former book by Mr. Fowler, UFOs, Interplanetary Visitors, upholds this more popular concept of UFOs, and many of the cases he describes tend to give strong support to that hypothesis. But here we have creatures of light, who find walls no obstacle to free passage into rooms, and who find no difficulty in exerting uncanny control over the witnesses' minds. If this represents an advanced technology, then it must incorporate the paranormal, just as our own incorporates transistors and computers. Somehow, they have mastered the puzzle of mind over matter. Of course, all this is predicated on the premise that this entire series of adventures is not the result of some complex psychological drama played in concert. If so, it would still be a fine case study in abnormal psychology. But more and more of these high strangeness cases are surfacing. Like the Andreasen case, they outrage our common sense, and they do constitute a challenge to our present belief systems. Those who become intrigued by the Andreasen narrative
would be well advised to acquaint themselves with accounts of other close encounters of the fourth kind, not only those in which regressive hypnosis is the chief source of information, as in the present case. One can dismiss the hypnosis reports as unreliable and fanciful, but this is much more difficult to do where the data source is the witness's conscious mind. Such information is available through serious UFO organizations like MUFON, Mutual UFO Network in Seguin, Texas, of which Mr. Fowler is one of the directors, and CUFOS, Center for UFO Studies, in Evanston, Illinois. Those who delve further into the fascinating world of the UFO phenomenon will come to understand for themselves the worldwide scope of the phenomenon and the problems and challenges that it presents. J. Allen Hynek, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois. Chapter 1. Prologue to the Incredible. In retrospect, Betty Ann Andreasen considered herself something of a tomboy. The minute she arrived home from school, she'd change clothes and head for pond or brook, field or wood, of rural Massachusetts. I'd stick my feet in the pond edge or walk through the brook's thick mud. Every season felt so alive to me. I felt as if I was part of it. Even now I feel total recall, the joy of standing by the cool rushing stream with soft white dew-covered flowers and skunk cabbage clustered in the swamp close by. Betty loved to feast on wild blackberries, blueberries, plums, hazelnuts, and elderberries. I used to climb large hemlock trees and pick lady slippers, jack in the pulpit, trilliums, mountain laurel. I would go deep into the woods and stay almost till dark. I was never afraid there. It was so peaceful. At 17, she became engaged to James Andreasen, 21, who had been in the Navy for 4 years. They were married on June 13, 1954, in Fitchburg. A year later, their first child, Becky, was born, and 6 other children followed swiftly after. Finding a house to accommodate their family had been no easy task. Finally, they bought a handyman special for no money down in South Ashburnham, a small town in northern Massachusetts. James, although a pipe fitter by trade, used his natural expertise in carpentry to make the former farmhouse comfortable for the bustling family. They tore down a crumbling wraparound porch and repainted the walls inside and out. South Ashburnham is typical of many New England towns. Rolling wooded hills and bordering lakes have gradually surrendered to the Cape Cod houses, ranches, and mobile homes that have usurped their territory. But remnants of a once active farming community are still evident. Abandoned orchards, tottering barns, and ivy-covered gray stone walls all bear silent witness to another day. The Andreasen children, Becky, age 11, James, age 10, Mark, age 9, Scott, age 7, Todd, age 6, Bonnie, age 4, and Cindy, age 3, became accustomed to the neighborhood, enjoying the company of their newfound friends. Secure in her vibrant Christian faith that had grown stronger over the years, Betty sought to instill the same faith and ideals within her own family. Each Sunday, Betty marshaled her well-scrubbed children to the local community church. The house and yard were always filled with children. We would sing songs and tell stories from the Bible and have fresh-baked cookies and milk. But 1966 had been a disrupted Christmas for the Andreasen family. The prospects for the new year of 1967 did not look bright. On December 23, 2 days before Christmas, a woman had pulled out of a blindside street and collided with the rear of James' gray Volkswagen sedan, sending him into a head-on collision with an oncoming automobile. Severely injured in the crash, James would need weeks in intensive care in the hospital, followed by months in traction. 11-year-old Becky was a great help to her mother in dealing with the many needs of her younger brothers and sisters. But with the prospects of James Andreasen being hospitalized for many months, and of Betty being faced with a host of responsibilities her husband had usually shouldered, extra help was desperately needed. Such were the circumstances that prompted Betty's parents to join the busy household to lend a helping hand. Betty's father, Wayno Aho, had immigrated from Finland as a young child when his family, seeking better opportunities in the United States, bought and worked a dairy farm in Massachusetts. Later, while on army leave from Fort Devens, Massachusetts, Wayno had met his future wife, Eva, a native New Englander. Betty was the second to youngest of Aho's five offspring. By mid-January, Betty's own seven children had become used to a new schedule of early suppers, designed to allow their mother a nightly visit with her husband at the local hospital. January 25 was one of those days, when the warm promise of spring hung dreamily in the air. The snow that had blanketed the ground for more than a month had all but vanished. Much later, under hypnosis, Becky would recall that on that balmy afternoon, she and her girlfriend had been playing in the nearby orchard. They were climbing one of the apple trees when her mother's call to supper echoed up into the orchard. About an hour later, after eating and helping with the dishes, Becky went out again, but now, as the last vestiges of daylight melted into the darkness, the mild temperature of the afternoon dropped rapidly, and Becky soon returned inside. Already, pools of mist were beginning to collect in the hollows around the old farmhouse, bringing the promise of a foggy night. As on most evenings, James Jr., Mark, Scott, Todd, and Bonnie had all been fed and dressed for bed and were watching television. On this evening, Bozo the Clown. Three-year-old Cindy was curled up on her grandmother's lap. Betty was in the kitchen, finishing up a few remaining chores. Suddenly, the electric lights began to flicker hesitantly, and then... 10 years later, under hypnosis, Betty and Becky Andreasen would describe the scene as follows. Betty. Suddenly, the lights were off, and we wondered, what was it? And we looked over, and there was a, by the window, the small kitchen window. I can see like a light, a sort of pink right now. And now the light is getting brighter. It's reddish-orange, and it's pulsating. I said to the children, be quiet and quick, get in the living room, and whatever it is will go away. It seemed like the whole house had a vacuum over it, like stillness all around, like stillness. Becky. The next thing I knew, Mom was going, shh, be quiet. There's some huge pulsating glow that was out in the kitchen. It was outside, like a big glow. The Andreasen kitchen had become a kaleidoscope of reflected color and dancing shadows keeping cadence with the flashing light. As the frightened Betty herded her excited children back into the living room, Betty's father hurried into the kitchen to see what was going on. Glancing into the backyard through the pantry window, Wayno Aho stared out in disbelief. What he saw is best described in his own signed statement. Despite the shaky handwriting, the old man's words carry a ring of conviction that is at odds with their bizarre import. These creatures that I saw through the window of Betty's house were just like Halloween freaks. I thought they had put on a funny kind of headdress imitating a moon man. It was funny the way they jumped one after the other, just like grasshoppers. When they saw me looking at them, they stopped. The one in front looked at me, and I felt kind of queer. That's all I knew. The Andreasen affair had begun. This book you are about to listen to deals with what is known, in the terminology of UFO investigators, as a CE4, a close encounter of the fourth kind. Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the title of the spectacular movie about UFOs, is a designation originated by Dr. J. Allen Hynek to describe specific types of UFO reports. In all, Dr. Hynek has coined six major categories. NL, nocturnal light, lights seen in the night sky. DD, daylight discs, distant disc-like objects seen during the day. RV, radar and visual, UFOs seen by radar and vision simultaneously. CE1, Close Encounter of the First Kind, a UFO seen within 500 feet. CE2, Close Encounter of the Second Kind, a CE1 that leaves physical traces. CE3, Close Encounter of the Third Kind, a CE1 with humanoid occupants seen. The Andreasen affair is more than just a classic example of a CE4, however. It is, again to use the jargon of the ufologists, a case of such high strangeness that even the most open-minded investigators were at first inclined to dismiss it out of hand. Yet it has become probably the best documented case of its kind to date, the subject of an intensive 12-month investigation conducted for the Center for UFO Studies, CUFOS, that involved, among other things, the recording of large quantities of testimony given under hypnosis, extensive lie detector testing of witnesses, detailed analysis of corroborative circumstantial evidence, careful character checks, exhaustive comparison with other CE4 accounts, and much more. The results of this investigation filled 3 volumes of a 528-page confidential report. But even after our disbelief had given way under the sheer weight of the supporting evidence, there remained and remains some baffling problems of interpretation. At certain points, Betty's narrative seems to deal with a reality so alien that it can be described only in metaphors, and perhaps only understood in terms of an altered state of consciousness. Because this book is also the story of how the Andreasen family's account was investigated and substantiated, perhaps I should begin by explaining how I, though skeptical at first, came to be involved. My own interest in the whole phenomenon of UFOs dates back to the late 1940s, when I began collecting and studying everything I could about the subject before joining the Air Force in January 1952. Since I had an amateur radio license and obtained high scores in radio and electronics, the Air Force chose to send me to a special school involving electronic espionage, after which I was assigned to the United States Air Force Security Service under the auspices of the National Security Agency. My involvement brought me in contact with information that indicated that the military took UFOs very seriously indeed. I was honorably discharged as an airman first class in December of 1955. In 1960, my continuing interest in UFOs prompted me to become an associate member of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, NICAP. In 1963, I began conducting personal on-site inquiries into local UFO sightings, submitting written reports of my investigations to NICAP and to the U.S. Air Force on an unsolicited basis. Later, I became an official NICAP investigator, and in November of 1964, became chairman of this group. My report on a classical UFO sighting that took place at Exeter, New Hampshire, instigated John G. Fuller's well-known book, Incident at Exeter, and became a major topic of discussion during the first open congressional hearings on UFOs in April 1966. In 1971, I became Massachusetts State Director for an international group called the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON. While remaining with NICAP as a consultant, I also became a scientific associate and investigator for the Center for UFO Studies, directed by Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who formerly had served the U.S. Air Force projects Sign, Grudge, and Blue Book as chief astronomical consultant for about 20 years. In 1975, MUFON appointed me as National Director of Investigations. One of my first tasks concerning this new assignment was to write and edit a detailed UFO Investigators Field Manual, which was published in 1975, and has since been adopted for use by the Center for UFO Studies and other groups abroad. The manual closely followed many of the investigative procedures recommended by Dr. Hynek. Unfortunately, many sightings in all categories go unreported to official agencies. It is estimated that only 10% of all witnesses to UFO sightings ever file a report. And the stranger the experience, the less likely it will be reported. CE4s may be the key to the entire UFO mystery, but of all categories of reports, they are the most inherently unbelievable and the most difficult to verify. And to complicate the problem, the memories of witnesses to a CE4 often seem to have suffered a strangely selective amnesia. In abduction cases particularly, most witnesses recollect only a close-up UFO sighting. A few may remember seeing alien creatures, but rarely do they recall many details. The actual contact or abduction experience has somehow been erased, perhaps mercifully so, from their conscious minds. Later, vague flashbacks, dreams, and intuitive feelings cause witnesses to suspect that something unusual has happened to them. And nonetheless, details of the abduction experience remain locked in the deepest recesses of their minds. Where does someone go to report a UFO experience so bizarre that one hesitates to discuss it with either family or friends? Where does one turn when government officials have publicly decreed that UFOs do not exist? Such was the plight of the Andreasen family. During the following years, the hazy yet vivid experience had weighed heavily on the thoughts of Betty. Her daughter Becky thought it had been a bad dream, and yet it seemed so real. At times, Betty would receive mental flashbacks concerning the weird episode. Provocative insights and alien scenes surfaced momentarily from her subconscious, only to slip away as her conscious mind sought to retain them. Thus, in 1974, when the National Enquirer solicited first-hand UFO accounts for consideration by a panel of scientists, Betty was one of those who responded, hesitantly reporting the vague details that she remembered. Her reply was a form letter from the Enquirer expressing no interest in the incident, frustrating Betty's hopes of casting light on what had happened to her family. Then, in August 1975, she read an article about the Center for UFO Studies in a local newspaper. The news story reported that Center Director Dr. J. Allen Hynek was requesting UFO reports for scientific study. Betty sat down and penned a fateful letter, describing the sketchy details of what seemed to have been a CE-4. To Dr. Hynek, August 20, 1975. I am so happy to read someone is finally studying about UFOs. Now I can tell someone of my experience, an encounter in 1967 with UFO occupants. Dr. Hynek received Betty's letter and filed it for some months before resurrecting it and sending it to MUFON's Humanoid Study Group, which had requested copies of all such CE-4 cases from the files of the Center for UFO Studies in order to prepare a computer-generated listing. After some discussion, the study group decided that Mrs. Andreasen's account might be worth looking into. Because Betty's UFO experience had occurred in Massachusetts, the study group had asked MUFON investigators in that state to inquire into the case for them. In January 1977, field investigator Jules Valancourt initiated an investigation. It soon became evident that to produce any meaningful results, we would have to be able to unlock whatever memories were still buried in Betty's and Becky's unconscious minds. We recalled that a similar problem had come up with the classic UFO abduction case involving Betty and Barney Hill that was described in John Fuller's The Interrupted Journey. Although remembering an initial CE-4, the Hills nevertheless could not account for a portion of time immediately afterward. It was recommended that they secure the services of a psychiatrist, Benjamin Simon, M.D., and during the course of his treatment, Dr. Simon used hypnotic regression to help the Hills consciously recall the missing hours. A similar procedure seemed indicated for the Andreasen affair. Harold J. Edelstein, who directs the New England Institute of Hypnosis, is one of few persons who have pursued the art of hypnosis as a full-time career. Patients are referred to him from a number of local hospitals, including the Sydney Farber Cancer Center and the Massachusetts Rehabilitation Psychiatric Department. In addition to his work within the Institute, he serves as staff member to Comprehensive Psychological Services, Burlington, Massachusetts, and as faculty instructor at three colleges, and also serves a number of law enforcement agencies. Harold is, in short, a well-recognized expert in the practical use of hypnosis. He became involved as a consultant in UFO research through the influence of one of our MUFON investigators, Merlin Sheehan. While being treated for cancer at the New England Baptist Hospital, Merlin's doctor referred her to Dr. Edelstein to relieve the nauseating side effects of chemotherapy treatments. Though this was Harold's first experience with the UFO investigation, his warm personality and keen insight into human behavior soon enabled him to establish complete trust on the part of Becky and Betty. No simple task, as both women initially had severe misgivings about hypnosis. Both Betty and Becky were good subjects, and after a few sessions, it would only take a few minutes to put either of them in a deep trance. Dr. Edelstein feels it would be unethical to describe in a book for general audiences the exact methodology that he used to induce hypnosis. I can report, however, that he employed such devices as key words and slight pressure with his hands. I remember that he once pointed his finger at Betty to show us her reaction. She went out like a light, and her body went limp like a rag doll. During deep trance hypnotic regression sessions, Betty and Becky relived their traumatic experience in great detail. They each expressed natural apprehension, fear, wonder, concern, pain, and joy. Their facial expressions, voice tones, and tears were obviously genuine. The MUFON state director, Joseph Santangelo, kept me abreast of developments. Initially skeptical, I nonetheless was curious and listened carefully to tapes made of the hypnosis and debriefing session. It soon became apparent to me that both witnesses were wholly sincere. When preliminary lie detector tests indicated that the witnesses were indeed telling the truth, I joined the team as a principal investigator and began attending sessions on June 4, 1977. If you belong to the majority of adult Americans that believes UFOs exist, nearly 57% according to a 1978 Gallup poll, you might find it easier to believe that Betty's story, though certainly fantastic, is not fanciful. But even if you belong to the still skeptical minority, even though you may not share all of the conclusions we eventually drew from this investigation, I think you will find the evidence too substantial and compelling to be easily dismissed. Intricate elements of their story remain consistent over 12 months of cross-examinations. Subtle similarities with other reported CE4s added further corroboration. A rather unusual feature in this case is the abductee's artistic ability. When Betty attended Westminster Elementary School, art was her favorite subject after math and spelling, and she won first prize in many art contests. During our later investigation, she was able to provide detailed sketches relating to her experience, some depicting the interior of the UFO. In combination, these sketches produced powerful corroboration of her account of her experience. Much of this book consists of actual transcribed words of the hypnotized witnesses as they related and relived their CE4 to my colleagues and me. Other than editorial comments provided for clarity and organization, most of the account is taken directly from the transcribed hypnotic regression sessions, which have been rearranged so as to provide a strictly chronological sequence of the original experience. Is the story of the Andreasen affair true? For now, at least, each individual must draw his own conclusions until the time when an even more substantial CE4 casts a more definitive light on Betty's experience. You may find the account incredible and even incomprehensible in parts, but one thing has been established beyond the shadow of a doubt. The witnesses believed it happened, and so, for that matter, do I. Chapter 2. Uninvited Visitors. When the bright light first flashed through the kitchen window, Becky had returned into the living room in response to her mother's commands. Looking down the hallway into the kitchen, she noticed a dark silhouetted shape bobbing in front of the light source shining through the kitchen window. Then everything went black. At that same moment, Becky, her grandfather, and all family members except Betty found themselves unable to move, unaware of anything else. I will let the witnesses tell their story themselves. Jules, investigator.
What's happening, Betty?
Betty.
The lights are back on now, and there are beings standing there. and they're talking with me, but not with their mouths. They've got big heads.
Joseph, investigator. How did they get there, Betty?
Betty, they came through the door.
Joseph, did you open the door for them?
Betty, no.
Joseph, did they open the door?
Betty, no.
The four entities that had passed by the window entered the house by going through the kitchen door, not through the frame, but through the kitchen door itself. They passed through its solid wood as if it were non-existent.
Betty,
they came in like follow the leader. They are starting to come through the door now, right through the wood, one right after the other. It's amazing. Coming through. And I stood back a little. Was it real? And they are coming, one after another. Now they are all inside.
It was difficult for us to visualize what Betty was describing. Thus, after each session, Dr. Edelstein induced a post-hypnotic suggestion within her that she would remember the details of what she described while under hypnosis. Her ability to draw was fully utilized, and she supplied us with detailed pencil sketches, many of which are reproduced in this book.
Betty,
I was wondering, how did they ever do that? How did they get in here like that?
Betty balked as her mind frantically tried to grasp some logical explanation for what was happening. Then her strong Christian beliefs abruptly surfaced to provide a desperately sought rationale.
Betty, I'm thinking they must be angels, because Jesus was able to walk through doors and walls and walk on water. Must be angels. And scriptures keep coming into my mind where it says, entertain the stranger, for it may be angels unaware.
Although Betty is far from being fanatic in her beliefs, her pronounced fundamentalist Christian orientation undoubtedly colored her perception and interpretation of some of the events that befell her. The four entities hardly resembled conventional depictions of angels. They were identical, except for the leader, who appeared taller. The creatures had gray skins and large, outsized, pear-shaped heads. Their faces were mongoloid in appearance.
Betty. And the taller one. His left eye seems to quickly go up into a slit.
Large, wraparound, cat-like eyes stood in stark contrast to less prominent facial features, holes for noses and ears, and fixed, scar-like mouths. They wore shiny, dark blue, form-fitting uniforms. Each left sleeve was adorned with an emblem that resembled a bird with outstretched wings. Their three-digited hands were gloved, and they wore high shoes or boots. Betty stood transfixed, but an extraordinary calm settled over her. An aura of friendliness emanated from the alien intruders, and she was no longer frightened. The leader, who stood about 4 feet tall, identified himself as Quazga.
Harold, hypnotist.
Did they know your name?
Betty.
Yes, he called me Betty. It seemed like an oral sound, but I think it was a transformation of thought, but it seemed like an oral sound.
During the initial establishment of what seems to have been mental telepathy, Betty misconceived a mental impression generated by Quazga. The leader outstretched his hand, and she asked, "Do you want something to eat?" They merely nodded.
Betty.
And so I went and got some food from the refrigerator and a pan from the stove, and I started to cook some meat. The entities stared impassively at Betty momentarily, and then she received another mental impression.
Betty.
And I turned, because they said something to me, and they said, "We cannot eat food unless it is burned." And so I started to burn the meat, and they stepped back, astonished over the smoke that was coming up.
The beings corrected Betty as clearer images formed in her mind.
Betty.
And they said, "But that's not our kind of food. Our food is tried by fire. Knowledge tried by fire. Do you have any food like that?"
Betty's religious beliefs influenced her reply.
"Yes, I think I have some like that. It's in there."
The events that followed in rapid succession are utterly alien to the logical model of reality that we have been taught since early childhood. Like a computer that is automatically programmed to reject extraneous data, the human mind rejects such claims with the comfortable labels of hoax, dream, or hallucination. Betty, they followed me into the living room, and I looked, and I saw all my family as if time had stopped for them. And I wondered what happened, but I glanced down and picked up the Bible that was on the end table. I turned and I passed it to the leader. The leader passed me a little thin blue book in exchange. The entity who called himself Quazka took the Bible from her and held it in his hand. Betty's mind rebelled at what occurred next, because what she saw happen seemed impossible. Betty, the leader put the book, the Bible, in his hand, and he waved his hand over it, and other Bibles appeared, thicker than the original. Then he passed it to those beside him, and they took the books, and each one was spontaneous. They somehow flipped it, page by page, and looked down. Each page was pure white, luminous white. And then they stopped, and I started to look in the little blue book. When Betty's oldest daughter, Becky, relived the episode under hypnosis, she recalled regaining consciousness at this very point. After blacking out, the next thing she remembered was seeing her mother conversing with the entities in the corner of the living room. Jules, where are you? In the hallway? Betty, I'm in the living room still. I'm over near the TV, and I'm just looking over to the left. Jules, what do you see? Becky, I don't even know what it is. There's something there, and it looks so scary. But Mom's okay. It was very unsettling watching and hearing Becky during the hypnotic session. Now, years after the event, a mature 22-year-old adult reclined in the hypnotist's chair. But the voice coming from her mouth was that of an 11-year-old child. Joseph, is this something, one thing, or many things? Becky, he looks like it's a clay man. He looks like a clay man talking to my mom. Some kind of man creature. And behind him, right behind him toward the right, there's one, a little one. And there are two after him that are just exactly like triplets. Joseph, how do you know they're men? Becky, I don't know. They just seem like men to me. They're men. They're really babies, but to me, I guess they would be more man than woman. They look like clay. They look like they're smooth, watered on clay. Jules, did they touch you? Becky, no, they didn't touch me. Jules, did they take you outside? Becky, no, they didn't take me outside or anything. They didn't even... I was standing right there watching them, and they knew I was standing right there watching them, and they knew that my other brothers, my brothers and my... Wait a minute. My one, two, three brothers were sitting there, and Grammy, she's over there. Oh, where's Grampy? Jules, he was with Grammy, right? You can't find Grampy? Becky, no, I can't see Grampy there. Jules, is Grampy in the kitchen? Becky, no, he's not. No one's in the kitchen. Grampy went out to look with Mom. He's looking out the window. Little Becky was visibly upset. When she awoke briefly from suspended animation, her grandfather had seemingly disappeared. In reality, he had gone to look at the flashing lights, first out the kitchen window and then out the pantry window. At the time Becky was looking for him, he was standing in suspended animation in the pantry, out of her sight. Joseph, did your mother give anything to the beings? Becky, I don't know. My mom was standing there with her hand on something, and that clay form had his hand on the other part, like a book. The clay hand is holding it on the right-hand side, and Mom is standing on the... Joseph, where did the book come from? Becky, the book? I don't know. She must have had it. I don't know. Becky had not seen the aliens enter the room with her mother. She had not witnessed the amazing duplication of the Bible, nor did she see them give her mother the blue book. When Becky regained consciousness, First thing she noticed was her mother looking at the blue book with Kwaska.
Becky, I woke up and they were in the room. Mom was talking to them, and there was a book already in his hand.
Jules, is the TV off?
Becky, yes, the TV. No, the TV is, it's different. No picture, no sound. Very, very dim, like you turn down the color. Like you turned it down so it's very gray and low.
Throughout the sessions, when Betty or Becky became anxious during certain segments of their experience, Dr. Edelstein reassured them. He sensed their particular needs instinctively at the right time and in a correct manner. The confidence and the precision with which he controlled the situation were most impressive.
Harold, Becky, you are upset about something, aren't you?
Becky, yes.
Harold, what are you upset about?
Becky, those things, they're scary.
Harold, they're scary?
But you told us that once before you felt a very, very close relationship to them, that you liked them.
Becky,
yes, they are very kind, and they don't mean any harm, but they are scary to look at. They look scary.
Harold, they look scary?
Okay, I want you to realize that you went through all of this without any harm befalling you. Is that right?
Becky.
Yes.
Harold.
Therefore, you have nothing to fear. Just relax. Just relax.
Becky was asked to describe the beings in detail.
Becky.
They were wearing, it looked like pants and a tucked-in type of shirt, but it was tight-fitted. Something like a, what it reminded me of was something like a scuba diving outfit that would be close to a person's skin.
Joseph.
Where did the bottom of the legs of the skin suit, where did they end?
Becky.
They ended near the shoe.
Joseph.
Could you see the bottom of it? Did it continue right around the foot?
Becky.
Yes, the bottom of it. The bottom of the first one had, like his pants went down like a skin suit, and then there was a cut where it was. It stopped with one lighter shade, and it went into a darker shade, like a shoe or a boot would be.
Fred, investigator.
Could you describe their eyes?
Becky.
They looked like marbles. It had big eyes.
Jules.
What about the eye slit? Did you see that move at all?
Becky.
No, I didn't see anything. Like him closing his eyes or opening them.
Fred. Do they have ears?
Becky.
I can't see it.
Fred. Do they have hair on their heads?
Becky.
No, I didn't see any hair. His head looked like a pear, an upside-down pear.
Fred,
did he have nostrils?
Becky,
I didn't even see a nose, so I don't know.
Fred,
a mouth?
Becky,
sideways he didn't have a mouth. When he turned he did. It was like a wrinkle in the clay. Not a line, but like a line. And I can't see any nose. I see there's a lot of shadow around. The only thing I can see really good was the big eyes, like marbles. They looked scary.
Harold.
Sleep for a moment. Just relax, relax, relax. Deeper and deeper.
Jules.
Are you afraid?
Becky.
Yeah, I'm afraid because he scares me by the way he looks, but I can't do anything. Can't move. I'm not afraid of him because there's a feeling that he's not going to hurt me. He scares me just by the way he looks.
Becky watched her mother and the little men as they looked at the small blue book.
Becky,
that book, it was bright, and Mom was thanking them for something, and so it must have been the blue book.
Instinctively, the taller entity became aware that Becky was awake.
Betty.
The head, the tallest one, looked right around across where the kids were, and Graham was, right over to me. And then he stopped when he saw me standing there. And then he went from me, right back around, and started talking or looking at Mom. And then, all I can see is nothing but darkness. Then, nothing. At that point, Becky lapsed back into unconsciousness. Let us return to Betty's vantage point as she examines the little blue book with the alien visitors.
Betty.
I started to look in the little blue book. And the first three pages were snow white, luminous white. And I saw the silver gray top thing with, like, coils. And there was sort of a wheel, and inside were four things. I can't make out what these things are. So I've come to the close of that book. Closed it. When Betty closed the book, the eyes of the entities focused on hers.
Betty.
Their eyes are so funny. One minute they are light, and now they've got a black ball in it. And they move straight, especially that left eye, and...
Betty had sought desperately to break through the strange tranquilizing effect that somehow shielded her mind from the reality of what was happening. She succeeded momentarily, and reported the following exchange.
"What are you doing here?"
Betty asked.
"We have come to help," the entities replied. "Will you help us?"
"How can I help?"
"Would you follow us?" the entities asked.
"Are you of God?" she demanded. "You keep saying you have come to help the world. Why?"
"Because the world is trying to destroy itself," they answered her.
"How can I help the world?" she sighed.
"Would you follow us?"
"If you are of God," Betty sighed again. "If you are here to help and are of God, I would follow. But do not deceive me."
"Would you follow us?" they repeated.
Betty's power to resist lessened as the entities stared hypnotically into her eyes. Their slow, repetitive invitation, "Would you follow us?" echoed within the deepest recesses of her mind. But again, her own powerful instincts surfaced.
"What about my children? My parents?"
"They are all right," Kwasgai answered. "Would you follow us?"
Jules.
"What was the rest of your family doing?"
Betty.
"They promised me they wouldn't hurt them, that they would be all right. They said... See, they're just resting there." There was no fear on their faces. It was as if they were unaware. They said, "They are all right. Would you follow us?" He keeps on repeating that. "Would you follow us?"
"Oh, Lord," Betty said softly. "Show me what I'm supposed to do."
"We will not harm you,"
the entities repeated. "Would you follow us?"
"All right,"
Betty replied, very softly.
Chapter 3. On Board. Betty.
He said, "Stand directly in back of me." And so I stood in back of him, and I swooped in somehow like suction. And immediately when I did, he was starting out the door, and I was going through the same thing, the wood, that they were.
Joseph. Nobody opened any door.
Betty.
No. I was right in their line. I was following the leader, and I guess they must have... their line must have a passage through.
Betty was no longer walking. She found herself floating several inches above the ground with a swooping motion that matched the movements of her abductors as they moved along together in single file.
Betty.
I'm just swooping along step by step as he moves. I'm moving the exact distance from him. The others evidently are following.
Peculiar foreign sensations pulsed through Betty's body.
Betty.
My legs feel very strange. My whole body does. Feels like it's weightless. Very funny. And we are outside. And he stopped.
Betty stared in disbelief. In her backyard, resting on its own struts, was an oval object with a raised central portion. This concerned the investigators. How could such a remarkable object remain undetected by the neighbors? We interrupted Betty to ask pertinent questions.
Ray.
How about the other houses?
Could you see the neighborhood?
Betty.
No. I saw haze, all haze.
Ray.
When you went out, how do you know that you were actually in the neighborhood?
Betty.
I didn't know except for the corner of the house and the ship. The rest of the part seemed very vague and hazy, like a mist was all around.
During the course of our investigation, the present owner of the house confirmed that the low area in the backyard is especially conducive to dense pockets of fog. Weather records for the night of January 25, 1967 indicated heavy mist in the area.
Debbie, Jules' wife.
How about the garage?
Betty.
I couldn't see that. And I couldn't see the opposite side of the house on this side. I could just see on this left-hand side, the house, the corner of the house, the stone wall, and the tree. Even past that, it seemed misty. It seemed as if the ship took up most of the area, too much for me to see past it.
Betty stood awestruck at the silent presence of the strange craft in the yard. Her initial shock quickly gave way to fear and apprehension. Koska seemed to have sensed this and, to reassure Betty, did a remarkable thing.
Betty, he says, see, you can trust me. Look over at the ship. And he made the bottom like glass. I could see through it. When the bottom of the craft suddenly became transparent, Betty recognized some of the things inside which she had seen illustrated in the blue book.
Betty, I see the part of those things I saw in the book. There are glass balls on the bottom, cut glass-like, and there are arms that come down and grasp onto it, and they go up, and there's that thing on the side, and they can rotate on an inner tube with that gray matter and that water, I guess, or something.
Betty sought in vain to find a comparative reference point to describe what she was observing.
What is it? She breathed.
What is it, Koska?
I have other things to show you, he replied. Come along. Come along.
Betty. And the ship turned back so that it was not glass, but like a silver gold. And I see the legs. And they are parked, sort of, on the hill. In other words, the length of the vehicle's legs on struts were adjusted to the incline of the hill adjoining the backyard. Koska faced the alien vehicle and raised his left hand. Instantaneously, an opening appeared in the craft.
Betty.
And, that door is opening. Automatically, I guess, or else he's making it. He raised his hand, and we are getting all lined up, and he swoops right up. There are three stairs. Soon as he goes up, I'm swooped up, and the others are following.
Betty found herself floating into a small room with curved walls. The door closed automatically behind them.
Betty. We're in like a half-bubble or quarter-of-a-bubble room, and he, Koska, has withdrawn himself with the others, and they are standing over there talking. I'm just looking at this room. Something goes down on the sides of the bubble. Where the steps come up, it goes down. I feel very weightless and icky. My hands and legs feel like they are asleep or something. And they are still talking over there, and they glance over at me once in a while. Oh, hurry up! And I'm crossing my arms now. I'm tired of just standing there. I feel weightless. Oh, my feet are pins and needles or something, even my arms and my hands. He's still talking, and about two or three of them are leaving. That door whooshed open, and they are going in. And it's closing.
Then Koska came over to Betty. Two entities still remained in the room and stood watching her.
Betty. He brought me over to where they were, and he is saying something to them about going and making himself ready. Would they please bring me to the upper room?
Betty and the entities left. Koska stayed behind.
Betty. And so the two, one went in front of me and one in back of me, and we went over to the furthest right-hand end of the quarter bubble. And whoosh! Another door opened. And you can't even see those doors. They just go up when they open. And there are stairs there, going around, somehow going around. They seem like they are floating up, but my waist feels so heavy there. And we are going up those stairs. Looks like I can see something down there. We're all going around the stairs, and we are going up around, and this door goes down. At this point, the hypnotist turned over the recording tape.
Harold.
Betty, I now want you to just remember where you are. You said, this door leads down.
When she was asked to continue her account, Betty quickly corrected him.
Betty, the door goes down. It doesn't lead down. It disappears down somehow. And now they are going into that room.
Betty, still positioned between the two silent beings, was perplexed at what she saw as she moved into a circular room.
Betty, I see that, box, or that desk and, see something else. It's, red and black. It's black, outlined with red. And it's some kind of mirrors, I think.
Softly.
I don't know. Seems like there are, in that circular room, big ripples like windows. They are leading me still.
Sigh.
And they are bringing me over to that further edge. Are bringing me further over there. And now they're stopping, and I'm standing there. And the two are withdrawing. They are saying that I'll be all right here for a time. How come I have to stay here? She asked them. An unseen force held Betty firmly in place, paralyzed except for head movement. She felt deserted and helpless. As she relived the episode, we saw the terror reflected on her face before us. Her pulse quickened, and the hypnotist quickly reacted.
Harold.
Betty, this is Dr. Edelstein. Just relax. Are you getting apprehensive right now?
Betty.
They are leaving me alone in there. At times, Dr. Edelstein suggested that he was with the witnesses to give them moral support.
Harold.
All right, Betty, just relax. This is me. I want you now to feel myself being with you to back you up. You've got nothing to fear. You can feel the fear leaving you, can't you? I'm by your side constantly. Continue. Go ahead. You have nothing to fear. Now substantially calmed, Betty tried to describe a variety of totally alien objects that she could see from her vantage point. But their utter strangeness prohibited her from describing them, except by comparing them with things already familiar to her.
Betty.
Okay. I'm standing there and looking around on the side. There, on the wall, there is a leaf motif, and, there's a thing up top there like a... It looks like a railing, but it isn't. And the room is sort of dome-shaped. There are leaf motifs to the right there, raised buttons on it, and there are shields and different symbols. And the desk is to the side, and I don't like feeling so held down in my body. I just see them to be able to move my head to look. They seem like they've controlled my body somehow, so I'm fixed, like in one place. And,
Harold,
are you becoming apprehensive?
Betty.
No.
Harold.
Fine. I'm still with you.
Betty.
Can you see the things?
Harold.
No, I can see them only through your eyes. Continue.
Betty.
I'm trying to see what else is there. I can't see way in back of me. There are those golden, those golden things, the cord and, some type of a scroll.
Betty, in the meantime, had waited impatiently and wondered what fate had in store for her when the alien beings returned.
Betty, I wish they'd hurry up. I'm tired of waiting here. It's getting brighter. They're getting it brighter down in here.
Softly.
What is that? I see something like a... Wonder if it's coming from the wall or is... What? They've opened something, pushed it out, and it's something like a camera works.
Softly.
I don't know what it is, but it's getting brighter in here. Much brighter now. What's that? There's somebody coming now for me. They said, would you follow me, please? And they stopped in front of me.
Harold.
Betty, is this Skwaska who is telling you this?
Betty.
No.
Harold.
All right. I want you now to lock this point in your mind. Lock this point. And when we start next time, you will carry on from this point in time. You will remember where you left off. Do you understand what I'm saying to you?
Betty.
Yes.
Harold.
You will store this particular spot in your subconscious mind. And when we start the next time, you will start from here and continue to go further. At this point, Betty recovered from hypnotic trance. The investigators awaited each following session with burning curiosity. What would happen next?
But 2 weeks passed before we met again with the witnesses in the offices of the New England Institute of Hypnosis. It was a hot, sultry June day. The steady drone of an air conditioner pervaded the otherwise silent atmosphere that soon enveloped the room as Dr. Edelstein prefaced the session by speaking into an activated tape recorder.
Harold.
Today's date is the 4th of June, 1977. The time is 12:21. This is a continuation of the session we made 2 weeks ago. Betty, I want you now to induce hypnosis into yourself.
Very good. Now deepen this hypnosis by relaxing. Let yourself relax. Let yourself relax. When I touch your shoulder, let yourself go into the deepest point of relaxation you have ever been. Deeper and deeper. Deep, deep relaxation. I want you now to take yourself back to the last session that we had. You will go back to that point. Tell me you are there. Are you there now? Fine. I want you to continue. We were amazed at how, week after week, the witnesses would pick up their accounts at the precise point where Dr. Edelstein had left off on the week before. Deep trance hypnosis, properly administered by a skillful hypnotist, can produce near total recall of everything a subject has ever experienced. In this trance state, a person must tell the truth as he or she believes the truth to be. Betty and Becky were turned off and on like biological tape recorders. It was fascinating to see a practical demonstration of the mind's remarkable facilities for storing memory. Betty. The lights are getting brighter and that door opened again. And there's somebody coming. I'm glad they are coming because it seemed like a long time in there. They're sort of gliding toward me, not moving their legs, but gliding. And it's one of the beings. Ah, it's two of the beings. They are waving their hands and telling me to follow them. I'm going over with them. And, ah, they are taking me over to the center of the room. One is in back of me and one is in front of me. I ask them, where are we going now? And they said, you will come over here. I went over to the center of the room and I stood there. And the one in front of me turned and looked at me. Again, Betty was instructed to assume the familiar follow-the-leader stance between the two entities. Abruptly, she found herself sinking through an opening in the floor. Betty, I'm standing there, and we are slowly, slowly being lowered through a tube. It looks like a silvery tube, slowly lowering down. We are going down. We are going down. We are stopping, and one of the beings tells me to get in back of him again. I'm getting in back of him, and the other one's in front of me, and the door is lifting up. Couldn't see the door before. The door just looked like a tube. Clear, straight through tube. I'm going out into another room that looks like a hatch or something on top there. Looks like lightning spears coming out of it. I don't know what it is, but it is there. And they are bringing me over to the side. The rectangular construction that Betty referred to as a hatch looked similar in appearance, but not in size, to the enclosed walkways employed at airports between terminal gates and parked aircraft. Its surface was marked with both jagged and straight lines, which looked to Betty like graphic representations for wind and lightning. At this time, the hatch extended downward out of the wall and into the floor. When Betty returned through this room later, the hatch had been telescoped into the wall, revealing an opening in the floor over which it had extended. Next, Betty was directed to a platform illuminated from above by streaks of dazzling light. Betty, I'm seeing this brighter light shining down, and it's shining down so much. It's leaving like, thin, tiny bars of light surrounding it, like you do in a cartoon with a light bulb, having streaks of light from it coming down. Would you get under that, please? The entities asked. Well, what is it first? Betty asked. It is just a cleansing thing. Well, will it hurt? No, the entities replied. It is just to cleanse you. Betty. And so they didn't touch me, but they held out their hands as if to assist me. There seems to be a platform there. Sigh. And I'm stepping on the platform. The light's above there, and it's bright, bright, and it's got those streaks of light coming out of it. It seems like it's moving me upward. The platform itself moved upward and immersed Betty in the brilliant light. Betty, the light is getting brighter and brighter. It's all engulfed in light, like I'm engulfed in light. I don't know if there is a covering or what, but I can't seem to see them. It's just bright white light. I'm just standing there. It doesn't seem to hurt. It is not hot. It's just white light all around me and on me. And now it is going back down. The platform is going back down. It is stopping. Betty stepped off it, and the entities said, Would you follow us, please? Now.
Where are we going? She asked.
Just please follow with us.
Betty. They motioned again for me to get to the back of them and follow the leader, and he walked to another place where a door is opening, whooshing open. Betty faced the opening to a darkened, wedge-shaped room. The lead entity gestured, holding out his hand for her to enter.
It was a little bit dark in there, Betty recalled.
Would you please change? The entity said.
I don't want to change, she protested.
Please.
Would you just please change?
But why do I have to?